KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The promises that he's made to the good senator, he's going to break those promises. You can take that one to the bank.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is approaching Senate confirmation as the next Secretary of Health and Human Services.
For Tuesday, February 4th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, I speak with the new chair of the Democratic National Committee about the future of the Democratic Party under President Trump.
We need to push back on some of the crazy things that Donald Trump is doing and the extremes of this administration. But we can't just live in that space and chase him down every rabbit hole.
And a preview of this Sunday's Super Bowl. The Kansas City Chiefs are going for their third straight championship.
Football was a little easier than basketball, less running. Honest to God, this is the conversation I had to have with myself when I was a senior in high school.
Those stories after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Meeting with Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House today, President Donald Trump says he wants the U.S. to take ownership of the Gaza Strip and redevelop it after Palestinians are resettled elsewhere. Trump making the announcement without much detail on how it would be carried out.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too. We'll own it and be responsible for dismantling all of the dangerous unexploded bombs and other weapons on the site. Level the site and get rid of the destroyed buildings, level it out.
Trump did not say how reconstruction would be paid for or received by the roughly 2 million Palestinians there. Hamas militant leaders who run Gaza quickly rejected the resettlement idea. Netanyahu again promised to eliminate Hamas, saying, quote, Israel's victory will be America's victory. The Trump administration is declaring telework agreements between federal agencies and their employees' unions invalid. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the latest guidance comes as President Trump's ordered most federal workers back to the office full-time.
In a memo sent out by the Office of Personnel Management, the Trump administration argues that heads of agencies have the right to set overall telework levels, citing the Telework Enhancement Act of 2010, and that any provisions in collective bargaining agreements that conflict with management rights are unlawful and cannot be enforced. The American Federation of Government Employees, which represents 800,000 civil servants, responded by accusing the Trump administration of violating the law by encouraging agencies to ignore union contracts. The union says the agreements are enforceable by law and has vowed to aggressively defend them. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s appointment to be the country's next health secretary appears on track. Kennedy, an activist lawyer who's campaigned against vaccination, clearing the Republican-controlled Senate Finance Committee by 14-13 votes, sending his nomination on to the full Senate. The nomination advanced after Republican Senator Bill Cassidy, a doctor, said he received assurances from Kennedy he would not do away with the nation's childhood vaccine programs. Search crews have recovered the remains of all 67 victims from the mid-air collision near Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport last week. NPR's Joel Rose reports crews are still removing debris.
Federal investigators are still trying to piece together the events that led to the collision of an American Airlines passenger jet and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter. The National Transportation Safety Board says data from an air traffic control display shows the helicopter was at 300 feet at the time of the collision, well above the 200-foot ceiling it was required to maintain. Investigators say they need more information from the wreckage of the helicopter, which they hope will be removed from the Potomac River later this week. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 134 points. The Nasdaq rose 262 points. This is NPR. Singer and actor Olga James has died. James starred in the 1954 movie adaptation of Carmen Jones, along with Harry Belafonte and Dorothy Dandridge. She was 95 years old. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this appreciation.
Olga James was a Juilliard-trained opera singer. She's also one of the few actors in Carmen Jones whose singing voice was not dubbed.
Joe, He was always my joy.
James was born in Washington, D.C. After Carmen Jones, she went on to star with Sammy Davis Jr. in the Broadway musical Mr. Wonderful, and beginning in the late 1960s, played Bill Cosby's sister-in-law on his eponymous TV show. Olga James was married to saxophonist Cannonball Adderley until his death in 1975. She later married folk singer Len Chandler. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
President Trump says he will attend the Super Bowl Sunday in New Orleans. Trump would be the first sitting president to do so. A spokesperson for the Secret Service says the organization has already put staff on the ground there, preparing for Trump's visit. As part of the Fox Network pregame show, Trump will also sit down for a pre-taped interview. Trump has not said who he'll be rooting for in the game. The Super Bowl is one of the biggest annual events on the global stage, with an estimated 123.7 million viewers tuning in last year. Crude oil futures prices came under pressure today on word of a 10% U.S. tariff on Chinese goods and retaliatory action against U.S. products. Oil down 46 cents a barrel to end the session at $72.70 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is one step closer to being the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. His nomination, which has been mired in controversy, cleared a major hurdle today in the Senate Finance Committee. So how did Kennedy make it past this step, and what should we expect going forward? For help understanding all of this, we are joined by NPR's Selena Semmenstuff, and she covers health policy for NPR. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
So, Selena, we were talking, and I understand you were telling me there was some genuine suspense earlier today about which way this vote was going to go. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so all eyes were trained on Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. He is a physician, and during Kennedy's confirmation hearings last week, Cassidy spoke about how much he believes in vaccines, how he's treated patients who were suffering because they were unvaccinated. And remember, Kennedy has built his reputation and fortune sowing doubts about vaccines and pushing the debunked theory that they are linked to autism. So Democrats were united in opposing Kennedy's nomination. So if he lost even one Republican vote in the committee, it could have gone the other way.
What happened?
So as you said, there was real suspense. Over the weekend, Cassidy even posted a quote from scripture on social media, "Be strong and courageous." He says he received hundreds of calls, but pretty quickly after the chair called the meeting to order, the committee held the vote and all Republicans voted yes, including Cassidy. It was really close, 14-4 and 13 against, along party lines.
Interesting. Okay, did Senator Cassidy explain what caused him to change his mind?
Well, he didn't exactly change his mind. He just was clear that he had reservations all along the way. And he spoke on the Senate floor about his decision and his vote. He laid out the commitments the Trump administration and Kennedy made to him about how they would protect vaccine policy. He said that as the chairman of the Senate's Health Committee, he and Kennedy at HHS would have a very close collaborative working relationship, which he says is unprecedented.
We will meet or speak multiple times a month. Mr. Kennedy has asked for my input into hiring decisions at HHS. He has also committed that he had worked within current vaccine approval and safety monitoring systems and not established parallel systems.
So on the Senate floor, he, you know, explained all this. He went on with some other items along the same lines. Basically, he said with these promises, he felt comfortable voting for Kennedy despite his decades of anti-vaccine advocacy. However, you know, politics are at play here, too.
Right.
Cassidy is up for re-election in 2026. He already has a challenger in that race in Louisiana. He also voted to convict in Trump's second impeachment trial. So if Cassidy had voted against Kennedy, that would have made it much harder for him to win re-election next year.
Now, Selena, I know that many public health and medical groups had lined up to oppose Kennedy's nomination. So tell us, what did they make of Cassidy's vote and the way that he explained it?
Well, you know, a lot of them were really disappointed.
Yeah.
In a press briefing after the vote, several public health experts essentially rolled their eyes at the promises Cassidy said he had secured on vaccines. Here's Dr. Georges Benjamin, president of the American Public Health Association, who has been an outspoken critic of Kennedy.
The promises that he's made to the good senator, he's going to break those promises. You can take that one to the bank.
Now, Kennedy does have one more step before he's officially confirmed as Secretary of HHS. The full Senate will vote on his nomination at some point soon. There is some question about how a few other Republicans will vote. One big question mark is Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. He is a polio survivor, and Kennedy has questioned the safety of the polio vaccine in the past, although now he's saying that he supports its continued availability. It is a very close margin in the Senate, as you know. So if Kennedy loses 4 Republican votes, he might not be confirmed. There is still a little bit of suspense here.
NPR's Selena Simmons-Steffen, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we want to turn now to focus a bit more on that key vote from Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana. As we know, Cassidy is a medical doctor, and he raised deep concerns last week about Kennedy's past comments on vaccines. Cassidy said that he's worried about the role those comments could play in parents choosing whether to vaccinate their children.
I just had a friend text me. 2 children died in an intensive care unit in a Baton Rouge hospital from vaccine-preventable diseases this past month. So my concern is that if there's any false note, any undermining of a mama's trust in vaccines, another person will die from a vaccine-preventable disease. Now, you've got a megaphone.
Well, a group of 100 physicians wrote Senator Bill Cassidy an open letter asking him to denounce Kennedy's nomination, arguing that Kennedy's position on vaccines makes him unfit to lead HHS. Jennifer Herricks is the founder of Louisiana Families for Vaccines, the group that organized that letter. She joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. So let me ask you, how are you feeling about Senator Cassidy's committee vote today, given the concerns he had previously expressed as a physician, not just as a lawmaker?
Disappointed doesn't seem to really be the right word, but feeling at a loss for words right now, but definitely beyond disappointed.
Well, real quick, can you just briefly tell us a little bit about your organization's work, Louisiana Families for Vaccines?
Sure, I would love to. So Louisiana Families for Vaccines formed in 2022. We saw, you know, there were a lot of bills coming up at the state level in regards to vaccine policy that were quite concerning. And really when we were watching, you know, hearings happening at the state level, we didn't see the voice of everyday families really represented. And we know that the majority of families in Louisiana and in other states choose to vaccinate. And so, you know, we decided to organize and to help those families get their voices heard. In 2022, in the state of Louisiana, there were 39 anti-vaccine bills that went to the state legislature. Mm. And, you know, we had a lot of success that year. We were able to stop 38 of those in the legislature, and one was vetoed by the governor.
Let me ask you, I mean, just to go back to Senator Cassidy, because he explained his committee vote on the floor of the Senate today, saying that, you know, he plans to check in with Kennedy several times a month if he is confirmed to be Secretary of HHS, that he will hold HHS accountable in his own position as chair of the Senate Health Committee. Do any of those personal reassurances alleviate any of your concerns about Kennedy being at the helm of that department?
No, they don't. Mr. Kennedy has a history of saying one thing and turning around and doing another. He also, you know, denies things that he has said and done in the past that have been harmful and that have caused direct harm to families here in the United States and in other countries. Samoa is a great example.
Well, as a vaccine advocate such as yourself, how do you see your work changing or reshaping under the second Trump administration and under a Secretary of HHS Kennedy?
Yeah, I think, you know, unfortunately, we may be heading towards a time where we see some of these diseases that, you know, people of my generation never had to experience. And I think it's going to be more important for families and for parents to really start to speak up and to advocate for themselves and for their children now so more than ever.
Jennifer Herricks is the founder of Louisiana Families for Vaccines. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. Stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. Today's story comes from Kara Beth Rogers. In 2008, her brother Luke passed away unexpectedly. Rogers was 20 years old at the time, studying abroad in Morocco, and she had to fly alone all the way back to the U.S. As soon as she boarded the plane, the grief became unbearable.
I will never forget the way that it felt to try to sit still. It was impossible. I couldn't stop moving. The strength of the emotions was so intense. I really stood out, and I felt like people were avoiding eye contact with me. They weren't really sure what to do with me. Partway through the flight, this man came up to me. I was sitting on the aisle on the right side of the plane, so he came up to me and he crouched down next to me on my left side. And he was so gentle. He made direct eye contact with me, and he spoke softly and slowly, and he was really sincere. And he said, "I don't know what's going on for you, but I want you to know that if you need anything, I'm here." And I said, "Thank you." I never ended up going to him during that flight, but knowing he saw me, you know, I felt like I was in this cavern of just like untenable emotion, and that I was deeply, deeply alone. And, you know, having lost a brother, we were so close in age. We grew up just 1 year in school apart, and knowing that I was on a plane with somebody that could see me and that knew that I needed something, even if I didn't know what it was, even if they didn't know what it was an incredibly powerful experience. I will forever be grateful for him. It was a really powerful moment for me.
Kara Beth Rogers lives in Los Angeles. You can find more stories of unsung heroes and learn how to submit your own at myunsunghero.org.
Support for My Unsung Hero comes from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsie Chang. President Trump declared that the U.S. would, quote, take over the Gaza Strip.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip, and we will do a job with it, too.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stood beside Trump as he spoke, and Netanyahu seemed open to the idea.
He has a different idea, and I think it's worth paying attention to this. We're talking about it. He's exploring it with his people, with his staff. I think it's something that could change history, and it's worthwhile really pursuing this avenue.
All right. NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram was at the press conference and joins us now from the White House. Hi, Deepa.
Hey there.
Okay. There are just so many factors here that Trump did not provide any detail on. Did he say anything about when this plan to take over Gaza would even happen?
No. I mean, there was pretty much no detail provided, like you said. And Trump announced this plan or, you know, idea for the first time at the press conference. He said he would be putting out more information in the next couple of weeks. But just to be clear here, I mean, the president is talking about taking over a sovereign territory. And I say territory, not country, because the United States doesn't recognize Palestine as a country. It's referred to as a territory.
Right.
And in this conference with Netanyahu, Trump repeatedly said that he wants the U.S. to, quote, own Gaza, to develop it, to rebuild it, create jobs there. He was asked by a reporter who he envisions living there afterward, after it's rebuilt and developed. And he said the people of the world could live there, including Palestinians. And he said that he sees this as a long-term ownership.
I do see a long-term ownership position, and I see it bringing great stability to that part of the Middle East and maybe the entire Middle East. And everybody I've spoken to, this was not a decision made lightly. Everybody I've spoken to loves the idea of the United States owning that piece of land, developing and creating thousands of jobs with something that will be magnificent.
He said later on that it would be the Riviera of the Middle East. And I just want to point out that in the past, Trump has expressed that the land in Gaza is in a good location by the ocean. It has nice weather. He said in an interview last year that it could be developed into, quote, the most beautiful place.
Okay, well, what does this plan or this potential plan mean for Palestinians who are living in Gaza right now?
Yeah, so Trump has been saying for a while now that he thinks Jordan and Egypt should take in Palestinians from Gaza, though none of the parties involved there are interested in that option. But despite that, Trump keeps repeating it and saying Gaza is, quote, a demolition site and thinks it's not habitable, it's dangerous. He keeps saying that he thinks Gazans are not going to want to live there if they have another place to go. And I will say there are about 2 million people who live in Gaza, and the living conditions there right now are dire. Very limited access to electricity. As you can imagine, they're recovering from a year plus of war. And it is a very difficult situation. But Trump is really not mincing words there.
Well, speaking of which, where do negotiations over a possible ceasefire deal stand at this point?
So Netanyahu is in town as negotiations of phase two of this ceasefire deal are ongoing. This is supposed to be about a formal end to the war. And the next step after that, phase three, is reconstruction. The original plan in phase three was that rebuilding Gaza would take 5 years. But Trump's envoy to the Middle East, Steve Witkoff, told reporters today that that's basically impossible and that because of the level of destruction, it would actually take about 10 to 15 years to rebuild. So it's unclear how Trump's idea to own Gaza fits into that. And I will say, if Trump has any authority to do this in the first place.
That is NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Thank you so much, Deepa.
Thank you.
Whether you like it or not, the Kansas City Chiefs are back in the Super Bowl. The Chiefs are chasing their third consecutive title. They would be the first in the Super Bowl era to achieve that if they win. Standing between them and history on Sunday are the Philadelphia Eagles. Our sports correspondent Becky Sullivan is there in New Orleans talking to coaches and players this week. Becky, dream assignment. Hey there.
Hey there.
All right, let's get some history out of the way first. How much is the three-peat on the minds of the Kansas City team?
Okay, so obviously you'd think this would have been on their minds all year long, but actually they've been very consistent about saying, whether you believe them or not, that it has not been a topic of conversation in the locker room this year. You'd ask and they'd say like, oh, it's just one game at a time, ma'am. Never even heard the word three-peat here. But now the time has come. They are just 60 minutes of football away from that achievement, and they are finally owning it. Here's Kansas City defensive lineman Chris Jones talking about it last night.
This is crazy. Three times back to back. This is crazy. I can't make it up. I'm so blessed, and I'm very fortunate.
And, you know, if they win, this is like Michael Jordan, 1990s Chicago Bulls type stuff. History that we will all look back on is one of the greatest runs of any sport ever, if they can get it done. And so I think it's fun to see the Chiefs finally admit to how close they are.
I mean, if they can get it done, that is the big question. So what are the Eagles' chances of stopping the Chiefs from that three-peat?
You know, I think Philadelphia, pound for pound, is probably a more talented team than the Chiefs, maybe the best overall roster in the NFL. Great on offensive line, defensive line, great secondary, great wide receivers. They have the best running back in the league in Saquon Barkley. And of course, they have the motivation to do it because they were just in the Super Bowl 2 years ago losing to the Chiefs. Mm-hmm. And that kind of loss takes a toll on these guys because it's really hard to reach the Super Bowl once, let alone twice. And that game 2 years ago, it was really close. It came down to the wire, 38-35, Kansas City victory. Philadelphia defensive end Brandon Graham was there, and he said it was just a brutal way to end it.
We did the best we could, but, man, the worst was the confetti right after the game. As soon as it struck zero, the confetti was on the field before you even got off.
Okay, Becky, you have still not told me yet. What are their chances?
True. Okay, so honestly, I think it's 50-50. Because the Eagles are so talented, that running back, Saquon Barkley, he can break loose for a 60-yard touchdown at any moment. Their quarterback, Jalen Hurts, had been shaky at times this season, but he looked at his very best in the Eagles' last game. And so when their offense is firing on all cylinders, it looks impossible to stop. The wild card that the Eagles have to face is Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs' quarterback. He is great all the time, of course, sets a very high bar. But what is wild about him is that all the statistics show is that he's better when the pressure is the highest. He's more accurate, he's more efficient, he adds more win percentage with every play in must-have moments, third downs, fourth downs, end-of-game scenarios, game-winning, game-tying drives. It's incredibly hard to stop him in those moments, and that's what I think it's going to come down to.
All right, I want to get into an unpopular topic for Chiefs fans, and that's the refs. There's been all this talk over the past couple of weeks about officiating in the NFL and whether the Chiefs have been the beneficiaries. Has that come up there?
Yeah, I should say that most of this talk is on social media, like a conspiracy theory, essentially. But NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell spoke to reporters yesterday, and this topic did come up. And he said flatly, it's ridiculous to suggest that it's like rigged or something. And he added that the NFL does evaluate referees in all kinds of ways, not just going through the tape to see if they got the calls right. Take a listen.
Our officials are evaluated in several ways. It's not just the performance on the field, but it's things that go on in their own lives. And we have a very tight controls over that. We monitor that very closely in a number of ways.
So next year, they'll take a look at expanding the role of replay officials who can step in on missed calls, and maybe more technology will help down the line.
That's NPR's Becky Sullivan in New Orleans ahead of the Super Bowl. Thanks, Becky, and have fun.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's been a tough few months for Iran.
The economy's in shambles. Their resistance axis has crumbled. There's historically high anti-regime sentiment.
Why some anti-government activists in Iran have found new hope against the hardline regime. That's on the next morning edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, on the moon, there were two canyons the size of the Grand Canyon, and they took only minutes to form.
These are extraordinary canyons, but they're hidden, if you will, and kind of mysterious.
Mapping these mysteries. That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Two groups of FBI agents are suing the Justice Department, the separate lawsuit seeking to block the DOJ from making public the names of agents who worked on January 6 Capitol riot cases. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
One of the lawsuits was filed by the FBI Agents Association, and the other by a group of nine anonymous FBI agents. In recent days, the Justice Department has sought to obtain a list of FBI officials who worked on the Capitol riot investigation and or cases involving now President Trump. Both lawsuits view this as a retaliatory measure and seek to block the Justice Department from making public any such list of FBI agents. The plaintiff's fear, among other things, is that if the list is released, it could open agents and their families to possible retribution by the 1,500 or so January 6 defendants who have been pardoned by President Trump. Ryan Lucas, NPR News at the Justice Department.
Trump has imposed a 10% tariff on all goods from China, but a proposed higher tariff on Canada and Mexico has been postponed for 30 days while the countries talk. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports that's welcome news to the U.S. auto industry.
Automakers like to say that the North American supply chain is highly integrated. What that means is that parts ping-pong between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, sometimes crossing the same border multiple times as they make their way through the complex manufacturing process. 25% tariffs would be a serious blow, even for cars assembled in the U.S. Trump has threatened these particular tariffs as a negotiating lever instead of a money raiser, giving companies hope they'd never actually go into effect. But that also makes them hard to plan for, because companies don't want to spend money to try to avoid a tariff that might be imposed briefly or never at all. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Stocks rebounded on Wall Street today. The tech-heavy NASDAQ added 262 points, up more than 1.25%. This is NPR. Reuters is reporting a U.S. military plane is deporting migrants to India, as NPR's Dia Hadid tells us. It comes after similar flights deported migrants to South American countries.
India has accepted repatriation flights in the past, but local media reports this is the first time a military plane has been used to return migrants. Bloomberg earlier reported that the U.S. plans to deport some 18,000 Indian migrants. That appears to be a sliver of the numbers of Indian migrants who are in the U.S. without legal authorization. The Pew Research Center estimated last year that there were over 700,000 such people, and it says Indians form the third largest block of migrants without legal authorization in the U.S. The Indian government has sought to get ahead of any potential flashpoints with the Trump administration by saying it will accept such repatriation flights. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Sri Perambudur.
In California, a lawsuit filed by a group of students against racial discrimination, accusing the University of California system of favoring Black and Latino students over Asian and white applicants. It alleges the 10-campus UC system admits some minority students at the expense of better qualified applicants in violation of state law that forbids considering race in public education. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump remade the Republican Party in his image, and now he is rapidly attempting to enact a sweeping agenda. His opposition, the Democratic Party, has lost control of the White House and Senate, and they remain the minority party in the House. But the Democratic National Committee has chosen a new chair. That is Ken Martin, who won internal election by large margin over the weekend. And Ken Martin joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you so much for having me, Juana. I'm very glad to be here.
Ken, I'd like to start with this if we can. The Trump administration is attempting to remake just about every aspect of the federal government through executive action. It is pushing cabinet nominees through Senate confirmation. How should Democrats respond? What do you think the party needs to be doing right now to oppose those measures?
Well, we need to stand up and fight back, for sure. I think what American people are hoping the Democratic Party does is grow a spine and get back in the fight. And I'm ready to do that, certainly. I have 2 days on the job, but I think the real question right now that Americans have to ask is, whose side are you on, right? And are you on the side of the robber baron, the union buster, the polluter, or are you on the side like the Democrats are, the American family and the farmer or the small business owner?
Let me jump in here. You said that your party needs to grow a spine to get back in the fight, but I just want to get really practical and granular yes. about this. What do you think the Democrats can do right now in opposition to President Trump's agenda to push back, to fight back, as you say? What does and should that look like?
Well, I think you saw that yesterday with a number of senators and, of course, congressional members talking about using the power they have in Congress to slow down some of the Trump appointees, to call the question, of course, to try to force their hand where they can. Of course, we don't have the majorities in Congress, and so it's hard to slow down what Donald Trump and the Republicans are doing right now. But the best thing we can do to stop Donald Trump's unimpeded power is to win elections, and that's why I'm here. And so we have big elections coming up in Virginia and New Jersey this year and other special elections for the U.S. House coming up that could put us back into the majority. And so if we really want to stop Donald Trump right now, and if people are pissed off about what he's doing, the best way to punch back and to fight back is to roll up your sleeves and help us build the infrastructure so we can win elections again.
Let me ask you about the electoral politics of all of this. When you look at the narratives that President Trump introduces every day, for example, he has blamed airplane crashes on DEI initiatives. He's attempted to associate all immigrants who have crossed the border illegally with criminal activity. What is the winning message for Democrats there? What kind of messages do you want to hear Democratic leaders respond with that you think are effective in winning back the folks who did not support Democrats in these most recent elections?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things I've talked about, which is really should have been the canary in the coal mine last year, was research that showed for the first time in modern history that the perceptions of the two political parties have changed. And now the majority of Americans believe that the Republican Party best represents the working class and the poor, and the Democratic Party is a party of the wealthy and the elites. That is a damning indictment on our party, and that's got to change. And one way to change that, of course, is to focus on a message that unites all Americans, which is economics and kitchen table issues. And for me, of course, we need to push back on some of the crazy things that Donald Trump is doing and the excesses and extremes of this administration. But we can't just live in that space and chase him down every rabbit hole, right? We need to give the American people a sense that we haven't forgotten about them. We haven't forgotten about their struggles and their lives. And while Donald Trump is failing the American people, we have to remind them that he made a lot of promises on the campaign trail, that he was going to make their lives easier. For so many people right now, they're looking at what he's been doing these last 2 weeks and scratching their head wondering, what is he actually doing to deliver on those promises? So we have to remind them that he has done nothing. For instance, I don't know how changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America helps anyone build a better life for their families.
Here's a question I have, though. I spent a lot of years covering national politics, including a focus on Democratic candidates and the Democratic Party and the Democratic electorate. And Defining who that party is, what it stands for, is something that has bedeviled so many people who have sat in your seat. How do you make the case to voters who want to support you that elected Democrats have their backs, given what we've seen in the last election cycle, where those working class voters that you just talked about who used to reliably vote Democratic, they've chosen a different path?
Well, we have to speak clear and loud and strong. Americans want a fighter. Working class people want a sense that we haven't forgotten about them, right? And so it's not just the perception and brand problem. It's also a messaging problem. And one thing it's not, by the way, is our message or our policy prescription. I hear a whole host of Democrats saying we need to come up with a new agenda. And, you know, I want you to take Missouri as an example. Last November, they voted for a minimum wage increase for paid family leave, as well as abortion protections, all by wide margins. They went down ballot and voted for Donald Trump and the Republicans. So clearly, we have to do a better job as a Democratic Party of connecting those very popular policy positions that Americans support by wide margins throughout this country back to our party and candidates, right? So many parts of our coalition have left us because they don't feel like we're fighting for them.
That was Ken Martin, the new chair of the Democratic National Committee. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Juana. Really appreciate it.
The Grand Canyon of Arizona formed over the course of millions of years through slow but steady erosion. Well, on the moon, there are two canyons of a similar size, but as NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, these lunar canyons were created in just minutes.
The two Grand Canyons on the moon are on the far side, near the South Pole.
These are extraordinary canyons, but they're hidden, if you will, and kind of mysterious.
David Kring is with the Lunar and Planetary Institute of the university's Space Research Association. He says these canyons look like straight lines. They radiate out from a big crater that was created billions of years ago when a comet or asteroid hit the moon.
Lunar geologists like myself have known about these canyons for 40 or 50 years, but we've never taken a close look at them.
Well, now they have. He and two colleagues used images from a NASA lunar orbiter to map the crater, the surrounding debris, and these canyons in order to understand how the canyons formed. He says when the moon got hit in that big impact, rock went flying into the air, creating the crater plus a curtain of debris that plummeted back down. Inside that debris, there were two concentrated streams of rock.
Those clusters of rock in that curtain hit the lunar surface in just a staccato series of impacts. Bang, 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 bang.
The impacts excavated a series of small craters that lined up like a chain, forming long, deep, straight canyons. How long did this take? In the journal Nature Communications, the researchers say they calculated that these canyons were created in about 10 minutes.
That would have been an extraordinary sight to see. Not that I would have wanted to be on the lunar surface, but I would have liked to have been a safe distance above the surface to watch all of this unfold.
He says the moon has some smaller canyons on the near side, the side that Earth can see, that formed in a similar way. On a clear night, they're visible below the moon's equator, looking like beautiful white rays that radiate out from a bright crater. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. European leaders met in Brussels this week for security talks. One thing that was high on the agenda was Greenland. President Donald Trump has threatened to take control of the island, suggesting it's important for maintaining regional security. But Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark, and as Denmark's prime minister reiterated this week, the island is not for sale. NPR's Central Europe correspondent Rob Schmitz joins us now from the Danish capital of Copenhagen. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
So, Rob, President Trump's musings about the United States taking Greenland have surprised a whole lot of foreign policy experts on this side of the Atlantic. But tell us, how are people there in Denmark reacting to this?
Yeah, they're just as surprised. And from my conversations with Danes these past few days, I'd also say that many people here feel, they sort of feel a sense of betrayal.
Say more about that. How so?
Yeah, so for decades, Denmark's been a close ally of the U.S. People here feel a sense of loyalty to the U.S. for its role in World War II and fending off the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War. And in many ways, Denmark has stood by the U.S. by sending troops to U.S.-led wars in Iraq and Afghanistan over the years. There's a partnership there that's based on history. So for President Trump to threaten to take a territory from Denmark feels very out of place. I spoke to Christine Nissen about this. She's a defense analyst for the think tank Europa.
It has disrupted the Danish and the European worldview in a way, because for Denmark, appeasing the US has been the number one goal for Danish foreign policy, security policy for the last couple of decades.
And Juana, you know, since the end of the Cold War, Danes have seen the US as holding up Europe's security against adversaries. But, you know, they never really thought the US would become an adversary.
Right. And as we mentioned, Rob, Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark, and there's an election coming up there in Greenland in about 2 months. How does that election play into all of this?
Yeah, I mean, nobody thought that a parliamentary election on an island of 57,000 people would become international news. But, you know, here we are. We're already seeing evidence that people in Greenland are bracing themselves for this. Today, Greenland's parliament debated a bill that would ban all foreign donations to political parties, a motion that was expected to pass. And in a recent poll on the island, 85% of Greenland's residents say they do not want to be part of the United States, and only 6% said that they would.
Rob, I want to ask you, we are leaving to travel to Greenland in several days, so I'm really curious to hear from you how people on the ground there in Copenhagen are feeling about all of this.
Yeah, well, you're going to get a different sense when you go to Greenland. But I think here in Copenhagen, you know, for many here, this is the first time that many have thought about Greenland at all. I mean, even though it's an autonomous territory of Denmark's, nobody I spoke to had visited it. And in the past week, Danish media outlets even had apologized for mispronouncing the names of Greenland's politicians because they barely cover the island. And I've heard all this has provided an opportunity for many Danes to learn more about Greenland. I spoke to Daniel Giallo about the prospect of Greenland becoming part of the U.S. He works as a plumber here in Copenhagen, and here's what he thinks.
The people from Greenland wants to sell. If that's what they want, they should do it. I don't think the Danish people should decide. The people from Greenland, they should decide. Is Denmark or American?
And Rob, what I think I'm hearing him say there is that he thinks that selling Greenland to the U.S. should not be a decision for Denmark. That right?
Yeah, you know, this isn't such an uncommon opinion here. Danes tend to see Greenland for what it is, an autonomous region that is able to vote on its own independence if it wants to.
That is NPR's Rob Schmitz joining us from Copenhagen. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Schools have historically been off limits for immigration enforcement, but all of that changed with President Trump. He quickly got rid of a decades-old policy that prevented agents from arresting migrants without legal status in sensitive places like schools, hospitals, and churches. Now, those locations are fair game to make arrests. There's no evidence ICE agents have gone into schools yet, but the prospect has sent shockwaves through some communities, as NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
In the days after President Donald Trump's inauguration, as rumors of immigration raids in Chicago started to pick up, Roy, a second-grade public school teacher in the city, says he noticed a shift.
Our attendance was pretty bad across the city, right? There were like 50 to 80% attendance. And a lot of parents were like, oh, they are sick.
Sure, he says, kids get sick. But about half of Roy's students are immigrants or children of immigrant parents. Many recently arrived, some without legal status. He suspected they were scared of exposing themselves to potential deportation, which is why Roy has asked that NPR withhold his last name and the name of his school. He says when attendance dipped, he sent an email to parents reminding them that Chicago is a sanctuary city, meaning local law enforcement are prohibited from cooperating with federal immigration enforcement. The next day, he says, most of the kids were back in class, but they were scared.
So one of my students who's from Honduras was like, well, Trump won yesterday. You know what that means? He's like, if you're from Venezuela, you're going back to Venezuela. If you're from Honduras, you're going to go back to Honduras. So I say, hey, we're not going to let them take you.
But how do you explain the complexities of immigration law to a six-year-old, he asks. Teachers don't actually have the power to stop any federal immigration agent who has a warrant. The Trump administration is sending mixed messages about schools. On the one hand, the new mandate says they are no longer off limits. But during a televised immigration raid in Chicago, border czar Tom Homan told TV personality Dr. Phil that ICE isn't going into schools.
Are you going into schools and arresting children at schools?
No.
Is anything like that happening?
No, sir.
Some states have indicated they will do all they can to support President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration, even in schools. Tennessee recently passed a series of anti-immigration measures, including a bill that would make it a felony for any local official to maintain sanctuary policies. And recently, the Oklahoma State Board of Education unanimously advanced a rule to request proof of citizenship or immigration status from families when they enroll their children in public schools. Here's Oklahoma Superintendent Ryan Walters on ABC affiliate KOCO.
We've got to know where the illegal immigrants are, what schools, what districts. And again, we have to make decisions on allocating resources. We have to make decisions as a state on how we're going to deal with those problems.
The rule still must be approved by the Oklahoma State Legislature and the governor. But in the meantime, for immigrant parents with uncertain legal status, everyday life has changed. A mom who works in hospitality in Chicago asked that we only use her first initial. Why? Because she worries about getting deported. Y has temporary protection from deportation after alleging employer exploitation. Just in case, her family now has a plan. We check in every 5 hours, she says. If someone doesn't show up, start checking the immigration detention website. Jasmine Garst, NPR News, New York.
Visual artist and curator Jean Quick to See Smith has died following a long battle with pancreatic cancer. She was 85 years old. NPR's Chloe Veltman reports that Smith helped to put the work of indigenous artists on the art world map.
Jean Quick to See Smith was a trailblazer. She was the first Native American artist to have a solo retrospective at the Whitney Museum in New York, and the first to have a painting acquired by the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C.
Jean's work is very visually appealing.
That's Smith's gallerist, Garth Grennan.
There's a pop quality to it. There's a story. So she's kind of a curator's dream.
Smith's work combines indigenous artistic traditions and symbols, such as trickster coyotes and rabbits, with Eurocentric modernist styles, such as abstract expressionism and pop art. It delivers a political punch, often with piercing humor. Here the artist is in a 1995 NPR story describing one of her paintings, featuring the label from a tin of Italian olive oil.
That has the picture of a Native American praying to the heavens, and this is not something that would ever happen on her reservation.
Smith said Native American people face these bizarre caricatures of themselves every day.
And by putting it here and making us look at it, we realized how ridiculous some of it really is.
Jean Quick to See Smith was born in 1940 on the Flathead Reservation in Montana. Her mother abandoned her when she was a toddler. Smith and her father, a horse trader, moved around a lot. The artist reminisced about how he would draw pictures of animals for her in a 2012 video for the Smithsonian.
It took me into a place that didn't have violence in it, didn't have hunger. It was just the most wonderful place to be.
Smith decided she wanted to be an artist after watching John Huston's 1952 film Moulin Rouge about Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec.
Fabulous artist. Famous lover.
According to the Smithsonian, she even posed for a photograph as the French painter in a neighbor's beret and painted goatee. But it was years before Smith was able to get a formal arts education and develop her career, owing to prejudices against indigenous and women artists. Tani Artone is the curator of Native American art at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri.
She experienced rejection very early in these academic art programs, and to be able to overcome that, that is about her determination.
Smith's career took off in the late 1970s and 80s. She had dozens of solo shows, collectors snapped up her work, major museums such as the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London acquired her art for their collections. And she was adept at hobnobbing with mainstream artists and their entourages. Artone says all of this sometimes caused friction in Native American art circles.
There were other artists that had a hard time with her success.
But Artone says Smith was deeply generous. She organized many group shows featuring indigenous artists, becoming the first artist ever to curate an exhibition at the National Gallery in 2023.
She's been a mentor to a lot of artists, a lot of writers, curators.
And Jean Quick to See Smith's love of nurturing the talents of others continues beyond the grave. An exhibition she curated featuring the work of 90 contemporary Native American artists just opened at Rutgers University. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Mathnasium, committed to making math fun and building confidence so students can achieve their potential this school year, offering customized math instruction and individual attention to students in grades K through 12, mathnasium.com. And from the Public Welfare.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.